A reading from the book of Genesis, chapter 27, verses 1 through 29. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, "My son," and he answered, "Here I am." He said, "Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death." And then, "Now then, take your weapons, your quiver, and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. And prepare for me delicious food, such as I love, and bring it to me so that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die." Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring me game and prepare for me delicious food, that I may eat it and bless you before the Lord before I die. Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice as I command you. Go to the flock and bring me 2 good young goats, so that I may prepare from them delicious food for your father, such as he loves. And you shall bring it to your father to eat, so that he may bless you before he dies." But Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall be seem to be mocking him and bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing." His mother said to him, "Let your curse be on me, my son. Only obey my voice and go bring them to me." So he went and took them and brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared delicious food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And the skins of the young goats she put on his hands and on the smooth part of his neck. And she put the delicious food and the bread, which she had prepared, into the hand of her son Jacob. So he went in to his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat of my game, that your soul may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Please come near so that I may feel you, my son, to know that you are really my son Esau or not." So Jacob went near to Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. He said, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered, "I am." Then he said, "Bring it near to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it near to him and he ate, and he brought him wine and he drank. Then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him. And Isaac smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you." The word of the Lord.
A continuation of our reading in the book of Genesis. As soon as Isaac had finished blessing Jacob, when Jacob had scarcely gone out from the presence of Isaac his father, Esau his brother came in from his hunting. He also prepared delicious food and brought it to his father, and he said to his father, "Let my father arise and eat of his son's game, that you may bless me." His father Isaac said to him, "Who are you?" He answered, "I am your son, your firstborn, Esau." Then Isaac trembled very violently and said, "Who is it then that hunted game and brought it to me? And I ate it all before you came, and I have blessed him. Yes, and he shall be blessed." As soon as Esau heard the words of his father, he cried out with an exceedingly great and bitter cry and said to his father, "Bless me, even me also, O my father." But he said, "Your brother came deceitfully, and he has taken away your blessing." Esau said, "Is he not rightly named Jacob? For he has cheated me these two times. He took away my birthright, and behold, now he has taken away my blessing." Then he said, "Have you not reserved a blessing for me?" Isaac answered and said to Esau, "Behold, I have made him lord over you, and all his brothers I have given to him for servants. And with grain and wine I have sustained him. What then can I do for you, my son?" Esau said to his father, "Have you but one blessing, my father? Bless me, even me also, O my father." And Esau lifted up his voice and wept. Then Isaac his father answered and said to him, "Behold, away from the fatness of the earth shall your dwelling be, and away from the dew of heaven on high. By your sword you shall live, and you shall serve your brother. And when you grow restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck." Now Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing with which his father had blessed him. And Esau said to himself, "The days of mourning for my father are approaching, and then I will kill my brother Jacob." But the words of Esau, her older brother, were told to Rebekah. So she sent and called Jacob, her younger son, and said to him, "Behold, your brother Esau comforts himself about you by planning to kill you. Now, therefore, my son, obey my voice. Arise, flee to Laban, my brother in Haran, and stay with him a while until your brother's fury turns away, until your brother's anger turns away from you, and he forgets what he has done to him, what you have done to him. Then I will send and bring you from there. What should I be bereft of you both in one day?" The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Our Father, we come before you as we look into your word and as we look at a family from among your people. We ask that that you would just open our hearts and open our minds, that we would see your son Jesus, that we would see ourselves clearly in light of who he is and in light of who you are, and that that you would give us both wisdom and courage to do what you are leading us to do. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Please be seated. You can turn to our two readings from Genesis 27. How did you feel about those two readings that we just listened to? It's where we're going to be spending most of our time this morning. There was a lot going on in those readings, wasn't there? As you listened to this story of Jacob obtaining a blessing, basically through an elaborate act of fraud, you may have come up with any number of questions. You might be wondering, well, what's the big deal with a birthright or with a blessing? And this narrative is from a very different culture than ours. You may be confused maybe by the family dynamics that are at work here. It seems rather complicated and rather fraught. You might even be wondering what kind of God would choose to work his purposes in the world through a family that is such a spectacular mess. And well, over the last few months here at Emmanuel, we have been going through the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is a book that is written to the people of ancient Israel, most likely as they were forming an identity after being liberated from slavery under Egypt. And so while it's a story of God choosing a people through whom to bless the world, to bring healing and restoration to a broken and sinful world, it's also a story about who God is, about what is the character of this God who created all things and has committed himself to seeing the people that he's created in his own image be restored and the rest of creation be brought into a state of flourishing. It's, in a sense, about what makes this God different than all the other gods out there. What makes him worth following? And so we're jumping back into this story of God's people and of God at one of the many crisis points that pops up in the book of Genesis. In the weeks before Easter, we looked at the story of God choosing Abraham to be a blessing to all the nations, that through his family line, all the nations of the world would be brought into this restored relationship with God, a relationship that had been broken when the first people, Adam and Eve, chose to reject God's leading and his relationship and do basically everything as they saw fit. And then later on in the story, we saw how Abraham and his wife Sarah had a hard time trusting God, trusting that he was, well, basically trustworthy. And they waited well into old age. They're waiting and waiting. They have this promise that they will have a son and heir, and he hasn't showed up. And then finally, they do have their son Isaac. But it's hard to have faith that God will bring blessing to all the nations of the world through your descendants when you're reaching your 90s and you haven't had a son yet. Right before Easter, we looked at the unsettling story of God testing Abraham by asking him to sacrifice this long-promised son, Isaac. And that itself brings up a whole lot of questions about God. And well, this week we're jumping ahead a little bit. We're looking at Isaac, but actually we're more looking at Isaac's twin sons, Jacob and Esau. We're actually basically skipping over most of Isaac's life and meeting him when he's old enough to be going blind and he's thinking about the day of his death. And it's interesting that the Bible basically glosses over most of Isaac's life. It's almost like he's a footnote to the main story. He's a secondary, excuse me, he's a secondary character that has a lot of stuff happen to him as a part of other people's stories. He's kind of a secondary character in his father and mother's story. The focus is on Abraham getting a son, and then Abraham then getting his son Isaac a wife. And then we kind of skip right ahead to this story of Isaac's twin sons, and that's what we're right in the middle of. And I think there's something new important to note about Isaac that we'll return to in a moment. He's present here in the story, but he's not really present. And what I want to do in the time that we have this morning is to basically focus on two things. The first is on the way in which Isaac's family faces wealth and uncertainty and the promise of God's blessing and basically makes a big mess of things. And the second thing is to look for where God is in all of this mess. What is he up to? What's going on? And what I want to argue for is that I think what we see here is an illustration of the Apostle Paul's description of how God works in the world when he says, in the letter to the Corinthian church in 1 Corinthians, he says, "But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even the things that are not, to bring to nothing the things that are." So with those words, let's take a look at Isaac's family. We have Isaac, the son of Abraham. We have Isaac's wife, Rebekah. And we have their twin sons, Jacob and Esau. There's a couple of essential parts to this story that we need to know in order to begin to make sense of this unfolding drama. The first is that when Rebekah was pregnant with these two boys that are in her womb, they seem to be really active, and we're told they struggled within her. And so Rebekah had prayed to the Lord, and she's basically asking, what's going on with these boys? And we're told that the Lord said to her in Genesis 25, 23, these words. He said, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger." And so we have this sort of prophecy or oracle, as it's called, that's kind of hovering over these boys' lives and hovering over the whole family. It seems that God, from before the time of Jacob and Esau's birth, is shaking up the cultural norms of the day. And the way that God is at work is grating against the ways of humanity. And maybe this shouldn't be unexpected, since humanity has often been trying to carve out an existence without God from the time of Adam and Eve. So in this culture, the firstborn son is the important one. He's the one who carries on the family line. And also in this son, the firstborn, in this culture, the firstborn son is entitled to a double portion of the inheritance. Since there's two sons here, there's only two sons, the firstborn stands to inherit basically everything. This is known as the birthright. It's this cultural practice called primogeniture. It's a way that things get handed on. And right as things, even before things are beginning, God seems to be choosing to break this cultural practice, where all the value and concerns placed on the firstborn son, often to the effect of disregarding and marginalizing all the others in the family. It's something that God's going to continue to disrupt many more times throughout the Bible. And so these birthright issues, this is what forms the main conflict throughout the lives of Jacob and Esau. Esau's the firstborn son, and Jacob's the younger brother. Jacob's the firstborn son by only a couple of seconds. They're twins, but he's still the firstborn. So the birthright belongs to Esau. But prior to the start of this story where we are reading here in our service sheets, Jacob, the younger of the two sons, he's already taken advantage of his brother once before. His brother Esau comes in hungry one day and basically he ends up selling his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of stew. And Jacob's name means something like grasping at the heel or deceptive. Like he came out grasping at the heel of his brother, but there's also this sense of he's not the most trustworthy guy. He's manipulative, and we'll actually see him live up to his name throughout his life. And we're told also that Esau despised Jacob because of this. One of the other things we know about the family is that they've actually managed to amass quite a bit of wealth by this time. And so there's actually quite a bit at stake here in the firstborn son and the secondborn son kind of wrestling over what the inheritance will be. So the birthright, it's been taken by Jacob under questionable circumstances. And then we fast forward a number of years to our passage. We find that Isaac has grown old, his eyesight is failing, and we find that Isaac and Rebekah, they don't actually have much of a relationship with each other. Each one has kind of taken on a favorite son, and Isaac favors Esau, Rebekah favors Jacob, and we have what here kind of plays out this kind of narrative of favoritism of the parents. And so even though by now Jacob has the birthright, Isaac still favors Esau, and Isaac wants to bless Esau. So let's take a brief look at each of the four people in this story in turn and see how they go about trying to either give or secure this blessing. This blessing, it's ultimately about power and control. It's about shaping and continuing on the family legacy. And perhaps as we look at these four people, you might see something of yourself in them in terms of how you grasp for power and control. And spoiler alert, these are not the best ways. These are not examples of the best ways to handle power and control. Oftentimes, the examples of what people do in the Bible are examples of what not to do. And I think this is one of these episodes. So first, there's Isaac. Isaac, I think, is just an example of putting your head down and just doing it your way no matter what when faced with uncertainty. Isaac is actually acting a little bit weird throughout this whole story. He calls Esau to him and tells him he wants to bless him. But usually this sort of thing would be a very public event. You'd make a really big deal about this. Yet Isaac seems to be doing it really quietly, almost in secret. Rebekah only finds out about it because she's eavesdropping on him. And normally, this sort of blessing would be done on the father's deathbed. Yet here, even though we're told that Isaac is getting older and he's losing some of his faculties, he actually lives on for many, many years after this. It seems like his reaction to everything that's going on right now is he's trying to control things as much as he can. He's trying to ensure that he gets to pass on the blessing to the person that he wants to. Even though there's this sense that that it's Jacob is the one who is going to be the favored one, even if Jacob is not the most upright guy. So it's as if Isaac is determined to hold up the status quo, what's expected in his culture, even when the signs are pushing back against that. One thing that is noticeable by absence here is God. God's not actually consulted throughout this whole time. He's kind of referenced to, but almost in a manipulative sort of way. But God's faded out of the background here. He's only referenced as a passing source of blessing. Moving on to Isaac, though. Moving back onto Isaac, he's also portrayed simply as ruled by his stomach. Did you notice how many times the word delicious is repeated throughout this? There's like delicious food. They're preparing delicious food. And I guess they have some pretty good cooks there, but I think there's something that's being drawn out. Esau, what's driving him here is his stomach, his comforts. They're a wealthy family, and Isaac, you know, he's kind of in a good spot financially, and he's just kind of, I want good food, and that's kind of what's driving him. And then he wants to just secure his family's future, his family's wealth, and he's going to pass things on to Esau. So Isaac just kind of plows ahead. Even when there's uncertainty about who he is blessing in verses 23 and 24, right? He thinks he hears Jacob's voice, and yet the smell and the feel of his son's hairy hands are like Esau's, and he's confused. And we're just told he's like, and so he blesses him. He doesn't like stop, he just blesses him. He thinks he's blessing Esau, but he blesses Jacob. But Isaac, he's not really providing any true direction or leadership in his family. He just kind of is existing. He's doing his own thing, coasting along, making sure his favorite son is set up right. And then when things don't go as planned, when this whole scheme kind of blows up, he's utterly devastated. He just cries out like he can't believe what has just transpired. And then there's Rebecca. Rebecca is all about scheming and plotting, right? Jacob is her favorite, and she will stop at nothing to see that he gets the blessing from his father. And so, you know, she's eavesdropping on Isaac, and when she hears what Isaac and Esau plans, she calls in Jacob and basically tells him what to do, right? Esau is going to go off hunting wild game, so Jacob, you run out. We've got some livestock. Go to the flock, kill two goats, right? Do this all really quickly while Esau's off going, and then you know, your mother, well, I'll prepare all this food because I know how your dad likes food prepared, and she sets up everything. She plans out this trick of Jacob to try to get the blessing instead of Esau. And so even when Jacob protests, right? He's like, well, but what if we get caught? She's just like, don't worry about it. It's not your concern. Like, any curses, it'll fall on me, right? Just you do what I'm telling you, and it's all going to work out. She's manipulating her son. And then Jacob, he's not really an innocent victim here either, is he? He's actually down with stealing this blessing. His only concern appears to be that he might get caught. He's just going with the flow of what his mom's doing. And then when his mom agrees to take the fall for him, he's like, all right, I'm all in. This sounds great. And so Jacob, you know, he's the son who does what he's told. He abdicates his responsibility here. And quite frankly, like, what's he got to lose? He's going to benefit from this. And so Jacob goes along with it. The last person in this family is Esau, right? He goes hunting. How does Esau react to everything when the deception plays out? Well, you know, he comes back in. Jacob has snuck in. He's stolen the blessing. And then it's there's kind of this awkward exchange between him and his dad, and his dad realizes, like, wait a minute, wait, who did I give the blessing to? There's this panic. And Esau, he just melts down. He's in panic. He begs and he pleads for some sort of blessing, like, Dad, can't you do anything? Like, there surely must be some sort of blessing for me. And really, as we read the story, like, if there's one person to feel sorry for here, it's Esau, right? Like, he was just off doing what his dad asked him to, and then suddenly his blessing's gone. And so by the end of the story, Isaac is a broken man. His dreams are dashed. Esau resolves to kill his brother. He's so irate at what his brother has done that he's like, if I see you, I'm going to kill you. And then Jacob is sent off by his mother off to live with his uncle in the hopes that Esau will calm down and have a change of heart and not want to kill his brother. And basically, Rebecca loses both of her sons here. She actually never does see Jacob again. So what do we make of this? What do we make of this tragedy? Well, obviously, this is not an example to follow, right? This isn't the family you want to pattern your family after. But it's easy to look at this family and to judge them and think, you know, thank God we're not like that, right? Or at least think, you know, well, my family isn't great, but at least we're not that bad. Or maybe you're thinking, like, well, at least my family isn't the only one that's completely messed up. But when we look at how this family, you know, this first generation to follow Abraham, the one chosen by God through whom to bless all the nations, and we look at this family, we see that it's become distracted by holding on to wealth and passing on wealth and trying to secure your own future, and they become combative and manipulative. And what we need to guard ourselves against holding them at a distance or sometimes even using them as an excuse to justify the dysfunction and sin that are in our own lives. Right? I think there's something in all of us that when we face uncertainty and confusion, or we feel threatened or desperate, or quite frankly, we just get selfish and we get greedy, or we think of doing, or maybe we actually do some of the most horrible things to each other. Maybe it's not in the way that this family does, but we have our ways. And so often we do it to the people closest to us, to our family, or to the people that we love, or we've had it done to us by people that we love or who say they love us. And I think there's also something in all of us that if we do things that we're ashamed of or that in the moment that there's this back and forth, there's something within all of us that seeks to justify what we did, right? Or maybe we've just only thought of it. And we do that by comparing ourselves to those other people, right? That dysfunctional family, that person who has an addiction, that person who abandoned their family, or the person who can't control their temper, right? Like, you can fill in the blank. We end up comparing ourselves. And, I'm not that bad. We're not that bad. If you feel that urge to do that, can I urge you to try to resist that desire to compare yourselves to Isaac's family? I think, though, that this family that we see here before us can serve as a bit of a window into our own lives if we let it. It can reveal the brokenness that we've inherited. Sometimes that we've inherited from our own families, or sometimes we've inherited through just right down from Adam and Eve. We're all broken in some ways, our relationships, what we've done. But where is God in all of this? Right? Like God's not really in this part of the passage, other than in passing. It kind of feels like he gets the ball rolling with Isaac's parents and promising this blessing to Abraham. And then, you know, we end up with this big mess yet again. And I think this is where the words of the Apostle Paul that I mentioned at the beginning of our time together help us to see what's going on. Paul said, but God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise, and he chose what's weak in the world to shame the strong. He chooses what's low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing the things that are. God works in the world in sometimes mysterious ways and sometimes ways that are hard to discern, but he generally works not by choosing the most powerful, most competent, most influential people who've got it all together, have the perfect family life, and never mess up. God has a habit of choosing the most unlikely people in the most unlikely of circumstances to bring blessings to them and through them. Here he chooses the second-born son, who is a deceptive manipulator, who is participating in defrauding his brother of the family blessing. And God's not condoning all of those things that Jacob does, but God's not afraid of the mess that he's in. He's not afraid of the messes that we find ourselves in or the messes that we make. And more than that, than all of that, God has a way of meeting us just in the mess and brokenness of our own lives. Wherever we are at, he'll see us through that mess if we let him. Because everything that we hope for is ultimately anchored in God's faithfulness to us, not in our own competencies and abilities. We can't make a mess so big that God can't handle it. And so a descendant of Isaac and of Jacob, if we move further and further on down the line, is Jesus, right? He's the one whom we celebrate this Easter season. God taking on our human nature, taking the mess that we have made, paying the price for our sin, all of our selfish ways. In Jesus, God takes on our frail human nature and dies a shameful death on the cross, taking on the form of a servant. And in rising from the dead, he breaks the power of sin in our lives, if only we turn to him. And while Jesus walked on the earth in his ministry that came before his death and resurrection, he was constantly living out and even modeling for us the way in which God works in the world. He doesn't shy away from the people who are a mess. He doesn't shy away from the outcasts. He doesn't look down upon them. We find him spending time with adulterers and a prostitute and tax collectors and a disciple that denies him three times. And Jesus doesn't just tolerate them. He was with them. He walked with them just as he walks with you or with me. And so don't let the mess that is in your own life keep you from letting Jesus in. God did not abandon Isaac or Jacob or their family. Somehow he saw things through to the point later on in the story where Jacob actually will yield to God's way of doing things, and Jacob's name is actually changed to a name most of us are more familiar with, Israel. And so while we can take these decisions that they make in their lives as a warning of when things are not right in our own life. When we look at Jacob and his whole family, we can look at them and see like, okay, this is not what to do. We can also look at them and see that something of the character of God, that God will not abandon his people. He won't abandon us. And we see that most clearly in Jesus coming to us. So when we're in the mess of things, when our life is going off the rails, and sometimes it is just through disobedience from just not listening to God, sometimes it's just we're just making a mess of it, sometimes it's just a mess has come to us, we're to look to Jesus. He will see us through. But I think there's one further challenge that this passage presents to us that I'll just bring up as we're coming to a close. Here at Emmanuel, we talk a lot about the beauty of Jesus. We have a saying, you know, that you've probably heard. If it's your first time hearing, maybe you have it, but it's written on the inside of our bulletin. It says that Emmanuel exists to see, reflect, and describe the beauty of Jesus Christ for the flourishing of New York City. And I think as Anglicans here especially, we like things like order and beauty and excellence, and we value things like the beautiful building that we worship in here, and things like our choir and good music and our liturgy, and all of those are really, really good things. And they're things that hopefully are drawing your hearts and your minds to Jesus. But I think beauty is also found in the most unexpected of places. And that's simply because Jesus is found in the most unexpected places. Beauty is often found in the margins. It's often found in the middle of the mess. That's the way God works in the world. God enters in. He enters into the mess. He doesn't take us out. He enters into it with us. And God chooses the foolish and the weak and the low and the despised. And even though like it may make great on us when we look at Isaac and Jacob and Esau and how are these guys being used? How's this family being used? God is still working in this weird and strange way. And so when we're seeking to see the beauty of Jesus, let's make sure we're looking in the right places. We do see the beauty of Jesus when we're worshiping, when we're singing, when we're gathered together. But we also see Jesus in each other, in the relationships that we're struggling with. Jesus is there, and he can bring healing. We can see Jesus in the parts of our lives that we're hiding and when we don't have it all together. Do you see Jesus in any of those places, or have you even looked for Jesus in any of those places? And do we see Jesus in the city that we live in? I know New York can be a hard place to live, especially when we have a random earthquake that shows up on a Friday morning. I know all the people from the West Coast were rolling their eyes and like, what's going on? But do we see Jesus in the city that we live in the people that irritate us, in the people that get on our nerves? Don't be surprised when, in fact, maybe we should probably expect to see God showing up in those unlooked-for ways among the people that we write off and the type of people we try to avoid and maybe we even judge. Beauty's found in Jesus reaching out to those on the margins, to those who don't have it all together. It's found in the middle of the mess too. And that's just the way that God works. He doesn't write us off. He doesn't write others off just because we don't have it all together. And so as we continue on in this Easter season, as we look to Jesus who has taken on our sin and died death for us and rose to life so that we can rise to new life, we're brought into this world of hope where Jesus brings healing in all these places. So challenge as we move on is to not avoid the mess, not to write off God, but let's look for him in the messes together and see the ways that he wants to bring healing to us. Amen.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jim Saladin. I'm the rector here at Emmanuel Anglican Church. Our church exists to see and describe and reflect the beauty of Jesus Christ for the flourishing of our city. And I hope this podcast encouraged you in that way towards Christ. If you're here in New York City, we'd love to see you. Please join us on Sundays at 11 a.m. Generosity drives everything we do at Emmanuel. And if you'd like to contribute, please visit www.emmanuelanglicanNYC.com/give.